We got to address the suburban women problem because it's real.
Suburban women helped determine the 2020 election, but there's more to us than the headlines would have you believe.
The suburbs aren't a homogenous sea of white people in perfect houses. Real change is happening in the suburbs, and we have things to say.
When women share their personal stories, walls come down and barriers are broken.
Welcome to the Suburban Women Problem, a podcast from Red, Wine, and Blue.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. I'm Jasmine Clark.
I'm Rachel Vindman.
I'm Amanda Weinstein.
And this is the Suburban Women Problem. So welcome, everyone. Today, we are going to actually talk about the right wing's current culture war that is targeting some of the most vulnerable in our communities, and that is trans children. And we will also have an opportunity to chat with the mother of a trans child, Jamie Jara. And then after that, I'll be joined by Chasten Buttigieg to talk LGBTQ representation, his book, and his favorite binge watch during the pandemic. Then, of course, we will touch on the Liz Cheney news. But first, I want to start with, how are we doing today? Good morning, y'all. How are things going? We survived the release of our first episode. How are y'all feeling?
It's exciting.
I'm feeling amazing. I had no idea it was going to have the response it did. I've seen the amazing things that Red, Wine, and Blue did. But for some reason, I was still unprepared. And my own research shows that because women are underrepresented in business, that they're underserved in markets. And for some reason, seeing it in real life, I was still just as shocked.
Yeah, it's been overwhelming in the best possible way. And I love reading the comments. I'm someone who always reads comments and reviews. That's sort of my jam. So I've especially enjoyed that part and just hearing how it resonates with people. And we picked a good week because there was a lot in the news about women, about Liz Cheney. So I think it particularly resonated with people last week. But I think the stories we have to tell and, you know, the model that we have planned for this is really going to resonate with people.
Yeah, I agree. I'm going to be really honest. I had no idea that it was going to be like this. Like, I was like, yeah, I think we will have a following. This is going to be awesome. I'm really excited. But then as the downloads started coming in and the reviews started coming in and the numbers started coming in, I was like, wow, this is big. Like, people really want to have these conversations. And so I'm just really excited that people see the value in what we're doing. So I just can't wait to continue to provide good content and to have those difficult conversations. Like, this is a big deal. This is awesome.
It is. And, you know, I'm very excited, for instance, about today's topic. It's a hard topic, and I'm ready to tackle on, you know, these hard topics and discuss them and just in a civilized way to listen to something that I might not understand, hear things and learn about them from a humanity perspective, from just, you know, treating someone with dignity and respect, starting there and then, you know, taking the conversation from that place.
Listeners, if you are listening to us right now, please leave a rating and a review so that other people can discover the Suburban Women Problem and enjoy it just as much as I hope you are enjoying it. Okay, so we have to talk about Liz Cheney and her ousting from the Republican Party. The GOP already had a Suburban Women Problem, but silencing Liz, they're kind of ensuring they're going to have a Suburban Women Problem for a very long time. And so I just kind of want to hear what you all think, especially since both of you actually used to be members of the Republican Party. What do you think this means for suburban women when they see what happened to Liz Cheney?
I mean, Liz Cheney's policies are more conservative than the person who replaced her, but she was still ousted, and she was ousted because she didn't defer. She didn't defer to the male leadership who are not trying to get her to follow along with conservative policies. They're trying to get her to tell a lie. I mean, this is not a party of policies or values. This is a party who wants women to defer to men based on political rhetoric, not policies, not values. And we know that her replacement will be someone who defers.
Yeah, not only would she not defer, she spoke the truth, which is really a problem for a lot of Republicans. I do not understand how they think this is a successful model going forward. It will only lose them votes. It will not gain them any votes. And, you know, I am not a mathematician, but if you look at the numbers, they are never going to win if they can't gain more voters. You know, that leads to some of their other shenanigans of trying to deny people the right to vote. And of course, we're going to be discussing that in the coming weeks. And, you know, the country needs to discuss that a lot, because that's the only game the Republicans have now, is to prevent people from voting. That is their only chance of winning.
It's just bad for our country. It's sad for our country. It's dangerous for our country. But I think that in the bigger picture, I think that it sends a message to women in general about where they stand in the party. You belong here as long as you agree with us. The moment you decide you want to speak out and say something completely different than what we're doing, or, you know, disagree with us, then you no longer have a place in our party.
I mean, Jasmine, that's such a good point. Like, she wasn't disagreeing on their conservative policies. That's not what she was disagreeing on. We raise our kids to do justice, to love mercy, to love one another. And the GOP's treatment of Liz Cheney is the exact opposite. So for women, I can't help but think, like, deep down, who we are as women, who we are as mothers, this does not connect with us. This is not how we teach our children. This is not how we want to treat each other. This doesn't represent us or our families.
And how many people have experienced in their lives telling the truth and being shunned for it?
Now, speaking truth of power is hard. And sometimes it means you'll never be that person who has power to change it. It's a hard choice.
Yeah, I had a similar situation actually here in Georgia in the legislature, where I just got kind of fed up with this good old boy ability to make a sexual joke out of everything while we were doing official business. Like, these things were on the record of the, you know, the official General Assembly. And, you know, one day I just got fed up about it. And I remember deciding that I was going to do something. And I remember the conversations I had with people, even people who I consider, you know, my allies, my friends, that were like, this is just the way it is down here, and you are opening yourself up to retaliation. I was like, I understand that, and I get that, and I accept that this could probably get me, you know, an office assignment in the broom closet. But at the end of the day, I still think it's important that we have a certain level of decorum. And so I think it is important that we say it.
I am so proud of you. The Sergeant Major of the Army last week tweeted that now that women can wear their hair in ponytails, there is an issue with men touching women's ponytails. Guys, I would not allow that in a kindergarten classroom or a preschool classroom. Everyone keep your hands to yourselves. This is very, very basic.
Yeah. Exactly. It was the same thing. That was a part of my speech where I was just like, you know, not that this is acceptable in other places, but if this were a middle school classroom, like, you all would be sent to the principal's office. Like, come on now. Let's do better as people, as adults who are members of an august body that, you know, are supposed to be, you know, exemplifying the seriousness of the role that we have in the state. We are legislators. We are lawmakers. We are not kids playing on the playground. We are not, you know, hanging out in a locker room. This is work. It's the work of the people. Let's do that. And let's do that without the butt jokes. Like, let's do that. All right. So I think it's time that we kind of transition into our topic of today. Let's talk about these anti-trans laws. More than 30 states have passed or are currently passing anti-trans legislation. Georgia is in that number, as well as people who have put forth anti-trans legislation. It's so frustrating. And in Florida, they passed a bill that would subject student athletes to genital inspections, which, as a mom, As an educator, as someone who teaches in anatomy and physiology and works with healthcare professionals, sounds absolutely horrifying. I mean, let's just talk about this. Trans people aren't new. Literally, trans people have been around for centuries. It's just that we are finally starting to hear about them because they are no longer feeling like they have to hide in a corner or hide who they are. I have friends that are trans adults, and I have friends who have trans children. And so I have actually had the opportunity to have conversations with them. And these conversations have opened my eyes. And I say this because I came into those conversations, and I can admit this, I came into those conversations maybe not really understanding the issue or understanding, being trans or having a trans child. And so I was all ears because I was starting with a clean slate. I needed to know all the information. I wanted to hear from them. I wanted to hear from their, hear their perspectives, hear about their experiences. As a mom, when I talk to the mother or the father of a trans child, to me, I'm talking to a parent, period. And so when they're talking about their child, trans or otherwise, I can empathize completely because I'm a mom and I know that I would not want my kids treated the way that some of these kids are treated. I don't like the way they're being treated in school, out in public, but then to have the weight of the government also deciding that they want to jump in on the bullying as well. It's really, really tragic to me.
I don't see trans people out there preying on children. I do see people like Matt Gaetz out there preying on children, and the Republicans don't seem to have anything to say about that. So therefore, we know this is not the reason that they're doing it.
It's an excellent point. Perfect point.
So last week or a couple weeks ago, Stephanie Ruhle on MSNBC had an interview with the governor of West Virginia, who West Virginia had recently passed a law banning trans women from participating in sports, girls from participating in sports. And she asked a very pointed question. How many people does this affect in your state? He was unable to supply any instances that it affected people. That's because there are none. However, West Virginia has a real problem with education. They have a problem with poverty, with children living below the poverty line. They have a problem with children being hungry, children being homeless. It's reprehensible. The people we elect need to solve problems that we have, not problems that they want to tell us that we have. To create a problem that can only be solved by them and then to look like a hero rather than actually solving problems that do exist. And, to echo Jasmine's thoughts, I also don't understand this. I don't have any personal experience. Many, many years ago, worked with someone who was going through the process, a more physical process to change their gender. Guess what? She could do her job and I could do mine, and it never really had to be an issue. I didn't let it bother me because it didn't affect me. I wanted to support her as a colleague and, a work friend, but it really wasn't something that occupied a lot of my time. I didn't care which bathroom she used or which pronouns she used to describe herself. I just asked her what she wanted and I went with it and everything was fine. I do not have the capacity in my day to worry about things that don't affect me. I suspect a lot of busy moms feel the same way. I have more than I can handle on my plate. As my dad used to always tell me, taking care of Rachel is a full-time job, and then I have other human beings that I'm responsible for as well. So I don't have a lot of time going around worrying about what other people do. And I also know this. We have to treat other human beings with dignity and respect. I'm looking forward to speaking to Jamie Jara, because when you have face-to-face, when you speak to someone and you hear someone in a position and you're really able to exercise that, you find a whole new place in your heart and your mind to relate to someone. And that's really what it's about.
All right. Welcome, Jamie Jara, to the podcast. And We want to thank you for being here. Jamie Jara is a mom who has been fighting for her trans daughter in Florida.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome, Jamie. I'm so excited that you were able to join us today. I think this topic is something that needs to be spoken about, and we need to not be afraid to have these conversations. So let's jump right into this. Could you tell us a little bit about your daughter, Dempsey?
Sure. She is 9 years old. She socially transitioned around age 5 after being diagnosed by medical professionals with gender dysphoria, which is the technical term for transgender. She's the youngest of 3, very sassy, outspoken, charismatic. And she's never really wavered from, you know, always saying I'm a girl in my heart, in my brain, always drew herself as a girl. And she's never wavered from that.
I'm sure, you know, watching what's going on around the country, it's really difficult to see the kinds of laws that are coming out in different states. And I believe you're in Florida. So even in your own state, what has this journey been like for you as the mom?
Really, a lot of it's been educating myself on how to best support and affirm and encourage her. And, you know, I didn't really know a lot of things regarding the trans community. So I really had to like catch up really fast. And have, you know, really reflect on my own insecurities and challenging myself to have really difficult conversations and sometimes confrontations with people who don't understand trans people. You know, developing thick skin, because I'm called all sorts of names, by strangers and in the online community. And just kind of having to deal with the frustration and aggravation of having your child being judged by people who don't even know her. So it's tough. It's really a lot of it is really having to, you know, stay calm and, you know, be positive and vocal, but at the same time, really challenging people about what they believe.
Yeah. Amanda and Rachel and I are all moms too. And so I completely empathize with the desire to protect our children no matter what, and to stand up for our children no matter what, and to go to bat for our children no matter what. And so before you came on, we were talking about how even we don't necessarily always understand, but I think if we start at a place of number one, your Dempsey is a human being and she deserves to be treated with the same respect and dignity as every other human being on this planet.
Exactly.
Let's start there. And then let's start with she's a child.
Exactly.
And she deserves to be treated like a child.
And I remember when I was pregnant with my first, I wanted to read every baby book out there, right? I wanted to read all of the instruction manuals for this little one who would be joining us. And the truth is, no baby book can cover it all. And I realized that very, very quickly, right? So what would you say to people, or what do you wish they knew about trans kids?
Yeah, they're just regular kids. They want to be loved. They want to be accepted. You know, a lot of times we get that, you know, people say, oh, she's so brave. She's so brave. But she shouldn't have to be brave to be herself. I mean, society is cruel and forces her to be brave, but society needs to change because, you know, she is just who she is and she's confident in who she is. And I guess the other thing that's important to remember when we talk about trans kids and trans adults is that, you know, being trans is just one facet of their identity. I mean, there's so much more than that. It's just one part. So, you know, while it's the part that's often, you know, attacked or looked down upon, it's only one part of, you know, my kid. She's so many more things.
Yeah. You know, Jamie, I wonder how is it different for you guys to have President Biden in the White House? You know, just it was, I'm sure it's a relief, but really, you know, practically, what do you think changed on January 20th?
Well, firstly, it was a huge, huge relief for us and our family. It was a huge celebration for us because, you know, after 4 years of constant attacks by the previous administration, it was, you know, it was really difficult, especially when you have, you know, at a federal level, that ally, which is amazing, versus what we had before. Because Biden is so vocal about it, at his level, it puts more positive visibility for trans people on a national level. But I also think at the same time, we need more than just words and of support and talk. You know, we need real action. We need protection. We need the passing of the Equality Act, because that's like our number one, you know, in our house. Like, it needs to be passed so that, you know, my kid and others like her are protected.
What would it mean for you if it's passed?
I mean, I'm always going to, you know, we all worry about our kids regardless. And at the end of the day, it's just a law. But at the same time, it signals change in the way society, you know, has to treat people. I'm almost speechless because I'm just wanting it to be passed so bad. I don't want to like jinx it. And it's been so much talk about it. And I feel like it needs to be done now. Like, it just needs to be completed at this point.
So speaking of laws, I'm a lawmaker here in Georgia, so just a little bit north of y'all. We had our share of anti-trans bills here, but they did not make it through the process. That, however, was not the case in Florida, where they were able to get a pretty nasty, pretty egregious anti-trans law passed. I know this is probably a difficult subject because it really hits close to home for you, but do you mind just kind of letting our listeners know, like, what is happening with that bill? What is in that bill?
Sure, absolutely. So this particular law in Florida targets only transgender girls and women. It doesn't address trans men at all. And it's prohibiting them from playing on school sports teams as girls, which is basically just perpetuating this misconception that they're not real girls. You know, they're boys who are, you know, somehow trying to, you know, masquerade as girls and, you know, win scholarships and all this stuff. So it's a solution to a problem that doesn't exist. I mean, for example, there was only 11 trans athletes that played competitively in the state within the past 10 years. 11. Like, that's it. So the Florida bill specifically was really invasive because they had put in their genital inspections, which is horrifying. They dropped that to get it through. But at the same time, just the fact that they were willing to do that is pretty horrendous. I mean, they're not listening. The lawmakers are not listening to scientific evidence, professionals, doctors, none of this. I mean, there's scientific data shows that, you know, trans females, whether they're prepubescent, whether they're on puberty blockers or have hormone replacement therapy, have no competitive advantage over their peers. So it's really just, I mean, it's nothing more than a witch hunt that they're, you know, on to really try to vilify transgender people.
So I know a lot of moms, a lot of people, really, we have a hard time understanding something until we experience it ourselves, right? Whether it's someone who is gay, whether it's someone who's trans, unless we've met that trans kid, we don't get it. And there can be judgment around that there's something that you did as a mom that made her trans, right? So I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit, like, what was it like seeing those little pieces of realizing who she was, or like understanding her trying to tell you who she was?
It was hard because she always kind of gravitated towards girl things, like, quote, girl things, you know, but she wasn't verbal, you know, at two. She didn't know that word. We didn't know it for her. I mean, we didn't know that was, you know, what was happening. We just thought that she was interested in different things and we kind of let her explore. But then, you know, anytime, you know, she wanted, you know, to, for example, to dress up as a princess, she was really into princesses at one point. And we would let her do it at home, but then, you know, to go to school, we would make her take it off. And it was devastating to her. Like, I mean, she would cry and have these horrible tantrums. I mean, the same thing with getting her hair cut. When we would go take her to the barber, I mean, we'd have to physically restrain her to get her hair cut. And, you know, it's difficult because looking back, I remember these things and I feel guilty because I didn't know that I was hurting her. I didn't know it then. I thought I was protecting her. I didn't want her to get picked on. I didn't want her to, you know, get bullied. But at the same time, I was kind of being a bully. You know, I was not letting her be who she was. And so really, it's just following her lead and, you know, listening to the experts, listening to doctors, having support groups, you know, that help us along the way. and just letting her be a kid. I mean, and she's just, that's exactly what she is. She's a kid and she's a typical 9-year-old girl who, you know, is into TikTok and all this stuff. You know, she's very normal in all regards. So, yeah, it's just little pieces that would add up. And finally, it was so big that we just couldn't ignore it anymore, you know. And we started to realize that we were harming her more than we were doing her good by not letting her be, you know, her authentic self.
Wow. I don't think I've ever heard it stated that. I mean, we all want the best for our kids. And it's hard to think that sometimes, oh, God, I don't know, I'm crying. That sometimes we were trying to do our best and it wasn't our best because we didn't know any better at the time. We hadn't experienced it ourselves. Nobody teaches this kind of stuff to new parents. They just like give you a kid from the hospital and like hope everything's okay, right? So I've also heard that some parents who go through this, you feel a loss yourself because you, even like from the birth of this child, you have a vision of what it means for, you know, when you give birth, for this boy to grow up. And
yeah.
And you have to have a new vision for your child. What was that like having that new vision?
So yeah, a lot of parents do feel a sense of mourning or a loss, you know, a grieving period. I myself and my husband did not. Because it's just kind of always been who Dempsey is. So it wasn't like it just fell out of the sky one day and it hit us as a big shock. So for us, I think it was because it was so, you know, step by step by step that it just progressed naturally, that it really wasn't a big thing for us. We kind of always just knew that, you know, she was going to be different. But I think we all have that, you know, whether or not our kid's trans or not. I mean, we all, you know, as a mom, as a parent, you know, we have this vision in our head of, you know, when my daughter gets married or whatever it may be. And they don't really turn out with the way that you think because they're their own individual people, you know, and they teach us so much about, you know, what we thought of what their life was going to be like. And it generally doesn't look like that, you know. So I think we all kind of have to start to think nowadays that, you know, we can want all these things for our children, but in the end, they're going to be who they are. And it's their authentic self and their reality and their life. And it's not ours to, you know, to say or set it, you know, a certain way.
I love that, Jamie. Thank you so much. Thank you for your bravery and just for everything you're doing, speaking out and educating parents just to create a better world for Dempsey. It's something that, again, even if I don't necessarily understand the space and I've never experienced it, I identify so much with what you're doing as a mom. And it's so inspiring. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up next is my interview with Chasten Buttigieg, where we talk about his book, talking about his life growing up as a gay kid in the Midwest and so much more. So stay tuned. Well, today we have with us Chasten Buttigieg, and I'm so excited to invite you to the Suburban Women Problem. How's your day going today?
It's going great. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So before we get started, I just want to tell you a story about your husband and how he randomly out of the blue texted me during my campaign in November. So first of all, it was hilarious because it was one of those moments where he called, I missed the call.
Aww.
And then I get a text message and the text message is pretty much like, hey, this is Pete Buttigieg. I'm just, you know, calling to catch up with you, you know, give me a call. And I was like, what? Like the Pete? I am so confused. But it was really awesome. He was actually calling to support my campaign in the election in 2020. And I went on to win. So I guess that was a good phone call to get. So Chasten, you are a teacher, you are a writer, you're an advocate for the LGBTQ community, and you are the husband of the former Mayor Pete, now Secretary Pete. So, I mean, let's just start there. Like, like, what is your day like, you know, being the husband of someone who is literally in the line of succession?
Yeah, well, things have changed dramatically. Being an advocate, trying to figure out what do I now do from this position that I am in? And how do I make sure that I make the most of this privilege that I have now? People listen to what you have to say. People are interested in your opinions. And I'm trying to figure out how to seize that moment and make sure that I'm still contributing to many of the ideas that we were talking about on the campaign trail, while also supporting my husband, while also creating a little bit of distance from my husband. I'm not campaigning with him anymore, right? So I don't have to be completely immersed in his world. I can figure out what to do for Chasten now.
So speaking of, you recently published a memoir called I Have Something to Tell You.
Yeah.
And it's about your experience as a gay kid growing up in a small Midwestern town. And I also heard that you adapted it for a younger audience. So what made you decide to do that? Well, first, before I ask you that, what was it like writing a memoir? I want to write a book one day. So what was it like writing a memoir?
It's one of the hardest things I've ever done. And when an agent approached me to write a book, I laughed at the idea. And I definitely said, I am not writing a memoir. You know, I'm 31 years old. That's far too young to write a memoir. But once I decided, yes, I'm going to do this, I really dove into the idea of creating something that is genuinely me. And I felt like a way I connected with voters out on the trail was being very vulnerable and trying to be as authentic as possible, to not create a different persona, but to share the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I do a lot of that in the book. Not only do I talk about growing up in the Midwest, coming out, all of those feelings and thoughts and emotions that I was experiencing as a closeted kid up here in conservative Northern Michigan, but also carrying all of those emotions through college and then falling in love with this guy who's also a mayor, to then quickly being very well known and watching him run for president. So the reason I wanted to adapt all of those feelings and adapt all of those emotions was because so many young people don't see themselves reflected like that.
Right.
I just hope that, you know, I'm writing it right now. So we're adapting the book right now, and I'm cutting out a lot and really focusing on those areas that I think young people need to hear more about, especially imposter syndrome, fitting in, trying to find your friends, figuring out who you truly are. And that right now is basically my full-time job. It's writing that book. And sometimes it's really hard to go down those old paths and remember what you were thinking and what you were feeling, especially in some of those darker moments of your life.
Right. So I can imagine. So it sounds like your life kind of went from like 0 to 100 really fast. You know, you fell in love with a mayor, and then you are in a relationship or you're married to a presidential candidate.
Yeah.
And now you're married to the Secretary of Transportation. And so today is about you. But, you know, we can't discount the fact that, you know, you're the first out spouse of a presidential candidate.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that in and of itself meant a lot to people in the LGBT community, as well as youth in the LGBTQ. I want to make sure I say it right. LGBTQ community as well. And so I kind of understand the burden of being like a first. I'm the first Black woman to be in my seat. I'm the first Democrat to be in my seat in any recent history. I'm the first person in science to be in this seat. So it's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
Like, how do you feel, or how did you deal with the pressure of, you know, you have this platform and you get to use that platform to make a difference? And so do you feel that pressure?
Absolutely. One of the best parts about being in this position is having that platform. Just yesterday, I was talking on Twitter about my mom's skin cancer surgery. She's been battling skin cancer for the last 15 years or so. And May is Skin Cancer Awareness Month. So I was just talking about mom's surgery, and thousands of people, right, will comment and talk about their journey with skin cancer and how hard it is for them and the importance of wearing your sunscreen. And you can spark these conversations and spark this awareness by simply putting a tweet out into the universe.
Right.
But on the flip side of that coin, you also have the ability to cause unnecessary press.
Yes.
For your husband, especially on the campaign trail, right? I never wanted to screw it up. I didn't want to be the one that sinks the ship. And you definitely don't want to distract from the candidate. So, of course, now that he's in the position he's in, I'm very mindful of the fact that, you know, everything he does is a reflection of the administration. Therefore, everything I do is a reflection of the administration. And that can be very scary, which oftentimes causes you to just want to shut down, disappear, don't say anything, because you don't want to, you know, be the one causing any drama. But I love having those genuine, authentic conversations on Twitter, talking about the importance of supporting the LGBTQ community. Most recently, talking about why we need to pass the Equality Act. The other day, I tweeted about how I gained 20 pounds during COVID. And one of my greatest lessons, I think, during COVID was just like, I just need to offer myself some grace. And I think everyone's going through this, and I'm going to stop beating myself up for it. And then again, thousands of people are weighing in saying like, thank you so much for saying something. I have been feeling terrible. And because you're a, you know, a more prominent figure, when you say something like that, it just helps other people feel like they belong. And in a way, having that platform, you kind of get to show up and be somebody that you wish you would have had when you were going through some of those things.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely understand that feeling of being able to make a difference, like almost immediately, just by reassuring people that what they're going through is they're not the only ones going through it. Yeah. And so that's it's really nice to have that type of platform. But I also completely empathize with the fear of saying the wrong thing. So as a state legislator in Georgia, but I'm seeing this across the country right now, there are a lot of Republicans that are engaging in these culture wars. And right now, the people who are getting attacked are trans kids, trans kids in sports, and just in general, finding ways to other trans children as if they even like as if they don't already have enough that they're going through. And now we've got the entire government, your state government, making laws that are attacking you. And it can, I'm sure it can feel pretty personal. Do you have any thoughts about these anti-trans bills or any of the anti-LGBT legislation that's going on across the country?
I have a lot of thoughts, and many of them I don't think I'm allowed to say on a podcast.
Gotcha.
I think oftentimes what I've experienced is this sort of this new wave, this like Trumpian Republican Party, sometimes when they have nothing of substance to add and nothing of substance to say or to contribute, they pick someone or a group who's very vulnerable. And recently, with this grotesque attack on the trans community, it is, you know, it's just a blatant example of their hatred and their phobia of anyone who is other, you know? And these are kids. We're talking about children.
Right.
And as a teacher, my heart really hurts when I think about my own students. If they were ever brave enough or willing to come out to a teacher, that is hard in of itself. And the Republican Party's acting like there are, you know, millions of trans kids now threatening to take over, you know, the sporting industry. Well, we're talking about children. We're talking about children who want to belong. And your job, especially as a person in elected office, is to protect them and keep them alive.
Right.
And a lot of the rhetoric coming out of the Republican Party is very threatening to their very existence. It is dangerous and it will cost lives. And it probably already has. And that is a terrifying thought. These are vulnerable young people who are looking up to those of us in positions of power to protect them and to keep them safe. And if a kid came to me and said, you know, Mr. B, I am trans and I also want to play sports, it is my job as an adult and as a teacher to cheer them on and to support them and create an environment at school and in this world where they feel like they can thrive. And I don't understand this small-mindedness and this fearfulness out of the Republican Party against children. I would think that the party who, you know, claims to like hold on to religion would be focused on feeding the hungry and housing, you know, the poor, but instead we're going to attack children. And I don't, their values are out of line if they have any.
Yeah, I think that is a good way of putting it. The values that they claim to have, it is questionable if those even exist. All right. So sliding door moments. Do you have any moments where you like look back and you think, if I would have made a different choice, my life would be completely different than what it is now?
Oh, Everything. I mean, I write about so many of them in the book, you know. What would have happened if I went to school and was confident in myself? What would have happened if I grew up in a place that accepted me and then I never would have had to run away from home and I never would have struggled through college? Actually, the summer I met Pete earlier that year, I had applied to be a flight attendant. And I was at this moment in my life where I was like, do I want to spend the next 5 years or so just going on an adventure? Or do I want to go to grad school? And do I want to hunker down? And do I want to start this teaching career? I had been substitute teaching in Chicago Public Schools for 2 years, and I had applied and got hired or got the offer at American Airlines and was like, I don't think this is for me. I think I'm going to go to grad school. And then later that summer, I met Pete. And I always wonder, like, what would have happened if I became a flight attendant? Or what would have happened if I didn't run away from home and I just stuck it out? You know, but all of those things, all of the hard things, and all of the really emotionally draining or traumatic things, they all just made me who I am today. And so I can't look back on any of those things with regret, because then I wouldn't be where I'm at. But I do wonder sometimes.
I definitely understand. I agree. We are like a compilation of all of our experiences, and just one different decision can definitely, you know, have you wondering, like, would I be here? Would I be doing this? Would I be talking to the Suburban Women Problem podcast right now? All right. So you've just published your memoir. I have something to tell you. Where can people find your book if they're interested in purchasing?
Oh, thank you. Well, I would encourage everyone to check out their local bookstore, their local independent bookstore, because after COVID, a lot of small independent bookstores got hit really hard. One of my favorites is The Brain Layer in South Bend, Indiana. It's a Black woman-owned business. But you can also go to places like IndieBound or bookshop.org, which kick back some of the proceeds to those local bookstores. So you can find a local bookstore, purchase it through the website, and they get a little kickback from that as well. But anywhere that you can purchase a book, you can probably find it. And I hope that folks enjoy the paperback coming out June 1st. There's a new preface that I wrote. And I really hope folks will share their feedback. I love participating in those conversations online after folks have read it and offered their opinions and shared their own stories.
Love it. All right. So now we go to the next part of our interview, where I'm going to ask you some rapid fire questions. Really quickly, just answer them. I promise they won't be too hard. This is not graded, so you won't get a grade. All right. Favorite binge watch in the last year?
I just finished the last season of Shrill. I love that, with Adi Bryant. She's incredible. Hilarious.
All right. Awesome. Favorite thing you learned during the pandemic?
To be graceful with myself.
Favorite wine or beverage, if you're not a wine drinker?
Oh, man. The answer to that is yes. if someone's bringing wine over, I'm there. Usually more of a red wine drinker.
Cab, Merlot.
Yes, yes, yes.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I gotcha. All right. First Broadway show you're seeing when theaters open?
Oh, I cannot wait to go back to Broadway. I don't care. Whatever I can get a ticket to, it doesn't matter. I cannot wait to be in a theater.
Yeah, you know, I have never been to a Broadway show. So
ever in your life?
No, not yet. Not yet. But one day I will.
We need to go to New York together.
Yes, let's do it. All right. What was the best thing about writing a book? And what was the hardest thing about writing a book?
The hardest thing was being vulnerable, saying, I'm going to write about this. I'm choosing to open up, especially when you're sharing drafts of the book and people are saying, are you really sure you want to go there? Are you really sure you want to go down that road? And choosing to say yes. What was the other question?
The best thing about writing a book.
Oh, the best is just seeing how many people have responded to the book and have shared their own story and said, I'm so glad he talked about that. This happened to me too. That has meant a lot. I dive into a lot of subjects in the book that I oftentimes think people in politics don't talk about, some dark stuff, some scary stuff, and then just some hilarious stuff, you know, like kissing a boy for the first time. And I just love hearing people's reactions and stories and feeling like we've created a little community where people feel like they belong.
Love it. All right. So I'm a dog mom. My dog's name is Stella. But what's your favorite part about being a dog dad?
Oh my gosh, they make me laugh all the time. Right when we started this recording, Buddy was in here trying to eat the houseplant in the corner. I mean, I'm not as productive because every time you pass them, right, you're like, well, I guess I need to snuggle them because they look very cute laying there.
All right, last question. This is a hard one. If you could listen to one song every day for the rest of your life,
oh, no.
What would that song be?
One song? I don't know. It'd have to be something like Dolly or Whitney or, you know, something that's classic that you can just turn the music up to.
Gotcha. Would you sing along or are you just going to
listen? In the privacy of my own home, I would. Yeah, maybe not in public.
Gotcha. Yeah, that would be a very hard question for me to answer too, because I love music. So I don't know if I would have been able to answer that one.
Yeah,
as well,
what's your answer?
Oh, I don't have one. I love music so much. Yeah. All genre, you know, I love dancing. I love singing. I love karaoke. So it's like,
I'm all over the place. It's very hard to pick a favorite.
All right, Chasten, this was awesome. Thank you so much for joining me today and for answering these questions. I look forward to hearing more about your book.
Thank you.
You're awesome.
Thanks
thank
so
you
much.
So much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back. Jasmine, it was great hearing your conversation with Chasten, and it was great talking to you, Jamie, about your family and your story and your beautiful daughter, Dempsey. Thank you for being here to share your story with us.
Thank you.
So before we go, we like to leave you with what we call a toast to joy. A toast to joy is basically our opportunity to talk about something amazing that has happened to us in our week. This week, my toast to joy is actually my son. My son is visiting me from Maryland, and y'all, he's about to be 15 years old, and I can't believe I'm about to be the mom of a kid who is about to learn how to drive. But, you know, honestly, I've just really enjoyed having him here and just seeing him kind of turn into a little man. And so, you know, as I had the opportunity to just kind of hang out with him and stuff, I wanted to make sure that I gave him some airtime and let him know that he is an amazing young man and I love the man that he's becoming. So my toast to joy is to Jacoby.
My toast to joy this week is a return to more normalcy. We have been going out more and doing more things, and it's all credit to science and the vaccine and people willing to trust science so that we can all get back to normal.
My toast to joy today is to Grandpa, aka Poppy, who brought us his famous chocolate chip cookies this week. I know everybody says this, but he makes the best chocolate chip cookies in the world. And I love that he shows my kids that he can be, so he's a millwright. So he's a millwright and Mr. Fix-It, but he also makes the best chocolate chip cookies and is the best baker I know. So I love that he gives this view to my kids that a man can be both those things. So my toast today is to Poppy. And Jamie, what are you toasting to this week?
So this week I'm toasting to my biological daughter, who I met for the first time this week, who is 19 years old. When I was in my early 20s, I made an anonymous egg donation to a woman so that she could realize her dream of becoming a mom. And my daughter and I were connected through DNA matching on Ancestry. And she flew down from New York to visit me this week. And I'm so grateful. And I'm just so happy that she's part of my life. My kids are so ecstatic and everyone's together. And so it's been an amazing week for us to just have total family time, and we're going to do the parks and Disney and Universal, and it's just been awesome.
Wow.
What an amazing gift.
All right. Well, thanks so much, everyone, for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on another episode of The Suburban Women Problem.